Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran dismisses the International Atomic Energy Agency's, quote, unfair report, saying it does not reflect the reality of the talks between the two sides. A gun violence monitoring organization says shooting incidents killed over 150 Americans during the weekend, leaving more than 400 injured. Also, the U.S. president says Washington will give Ukraine, quote, advanced rocket systems to hit key targets on the battlefield. Hello and welcome. It's good to have you with us. Iran says the latest reports by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency on its nuclear activities are unbalanced and unfair. According to Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh, the reports repeat the same errors that existed in the Director General's briefing to the European Parliament. He added that even the agency has admitted to those flaws before. Khatibzadeh urged the IAEA to avoid politicizing its reports under pressure from Israel and other parties. He also talked about efforts to revive the 2015 Iran deal, adding everything now hinges on the U.S. making the right decision.
The United States has unfortunately failed so far to give the required response. If the U.S. stops hesitating in its words and actions and moves toward making a political decision, there will be no impasse in the talks, and the small but outstanding issues in the agreement can be finalized. The current pause in the negotiations is because of U.S. failure to respond to the initiatives put forth by Iran and the European side.
Khatibzadeh added that what Iran needs more than anything now is guarantees that it will economically benefit from any agreement. He said other details, including the U.S. blacklisting of the IRGC, will have to be decided at the negotiating table. We've talked to political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas about the IAEA's recent report on Iran's nuclear program. He believes the agency is neither neutral nor independent. Let's take a listen.
IAEA is just yet another international institution which pretends to be neutral, pretends to be based on justice, and pretends to be equal and fair in the way it deals with global issues, particularly around the nuclear, of course, the nuclear question. The reality, of course, is something very different. Not one of the international institutions that often act as monitors or act as regulators or watchdogs or overseers of international actions of the various nations is independent. Not one of them. Not the WHO, not the United Nations, not the Atomic Energy Agency, not those who decide what happens with economics in the world, you know, whether it's the World Economic Forum. None of these institutions can ever be expected to act in a fair and balanced way because they were established and remain in the control of, clandestinely, of what I describe as the hyper-capitalist money mafia.
Gun violence continues to claim the lives of a staggering number of Americans. Over the Memorial Weekend alone, at least 156 people have been fatally shot across the United States. More than 400 others have also been injured between Friday and Tuesday. Preliminary data published by the Gun Violence Archive shows at least 14 mass shooting incidents took place in the U.S. in this period. Chicago has been the scene of two of the mass shootings, making it the most violent Memorial Day weekend there in 5 years. At least 9 people were killed and 42 others wounded in the city. The incidents took place only days after a mass shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, claimed 22 lives, including the attacker. The growing number of gun-related deaths has renewed the debate on gun control in the U.S. Americans' feelings about the economy have deteriorated over the past month amid concerns about inflation and job prospects. The survey shows that citizens' worries grew in May amid the fastest increase in U.S. consumer prices in more than 4 decades. The opinion poll also indicates the supply chain is sluggish as demand has outstripped supply. This, in turn, has fueled inflation. Moreover, most of the respondents are skeptical about the labor market and believe jobs are hard to get. According to the report, expectations are also weakening as consumers do not foresee the economy picking up steam in the months ahead. The U.S. president has confirmed that Washington will send more advanced rocket systems to Ukraine to strike what he said were key targets of Russian forces inside Ukraine. Joe Biden underlined in an op-ed article in the New York Times that the White House was neither encouraging nor enabling Ukraine to strike beyond its borders. He said the U.S. was not seeking a war between NATO and Russia. He also noted that the United States was not trying to bring about the ouster of Russian President Vladimir Putin. He made it clear that Washington will not directly get engaged in the Russia-Ukraine conflict as long as the U.S. or its allies were not attacked. While NATO continues to supply Ukraine with heavy weapons, our correspondent in Donetsk reports that some of those weapons may be being used to target and kill civilians.
An air raid siren over the separatist-held Donetsk. The Ukrainian army shells this city every day. School 22, an old building. It survived World War II, but not this conflict.
Earlier today, it was reported that two people were killed here, but that's been updated now. Three killed and five injured. And that's just one of the strikes that have happened here in Donetsk today.
My daughter studied here. Luckily, children are studying from home. The teachers were wounded. It's horrible. I don't know where my child is going to study. There's nothing you can comment upon. It's beyond human understanding. They are simply fascists who are trying to eliminate us. That's all. They just want to kill all Donbass people.
Another school nearby also hit. It's clear these institutions have been specifically targeted. There is blood on the pavement.
Yes, we had a horrible day today. We were working when the missile hit. It was big. One person died. Two are injured. One person's in hospital now. It's a very sad situation. For some reason, peaceful civilians are targeted, and they hit schools.
They just do not consider us to be human. They're only civilians here, children, women, and old people. We're separatists for them. We're non-human for them. Let it be in no man's land. That's their attitude.
Now, I've covered the strikes by the Ukrainian military on civilian targets here in Donetsk, quite a few of those strikes. But this one here and the one at the other school are on a completely different scale. The ammunition used is far larger. The potential death toll of strikes like this, far greater.
Workmen have put the shell casings on the back of a lorry. The Donetsk People's Republic say this is a 155mm shell, fired by the American-supplied M777 howitzer. 108 of these weapons were delivered to Ukraine by the US. Some have now reached the front line, meaning Ukraine can now blow up schools at a further distance.
If it's proven that NATO weapons were used, what would you say to NATO countries?
They act in a wrong way. Let them come here and see what they give to Ukraine, which is used against us. Let them come and see. I wish in this moment they were here, so they could feel it themselves.
In a battered geography classroom, there's a map of Great Britain and some flags. Today, the children who attend class here are being taught a different lesson about NATO countries, that their weapons are being used to target and kill civilians. Johnny Milip, Donetsk.
An energy war between Brussels and Moscow intensifies, pushing the cost of living to record highs for EU citizens. Economists warn of dire consequences as oil, gas, and electricity prices soar across the 27-country bloc. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Meeting in Brussels, EU leaders have agreed to place an embargo on 75% of Russian oil imports, increasing to 90% by the end of the year. 4 weeks ago, Moscow cut off gas supplies to EU countries Poland and Bulgaria. Now Russian gas to energy firms in Netherlands, Denmark and Germany is being switched off. EU leaders say they won't back down and will continue to send arms to Ukraine.
Since the beginning of the war, leaders and the member states stepped up and announced by now 200 billion euros in extra military spending.
It is clear that most citizens don't support the move.
We are still just speaking about sanctions, giving arms and stuff. We need to speak about peace and diplomacy.
I'm against spending more and more money for weapons because that is only going to end up in more conflict, because the only purpose of weapons is to use them against somebody else.
Amid criticism from US war hawks, German and French leaders have been defending their decision to keep lines of communication open with the Kremlin.
I do endorse discussing with Vladimir Putin on a regular basis, with very demanding approach and full transparency with President Zelensky.
Many analysts suggest the West created this crisis by not listening to Russia's security concerns, and apparent efforts to reach out to Moscow recently are merely a charade. EU leaders have now returned to their capitals, but senior officials here at the European Commission have told Press TV that work is well underway on a seventh round of sanctions targeting Russia. Peace activists continue to ask the question, why does all the emphasis seem to be on escalation rather than diplomacy? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
French unions took to the streets around the country as new data shows that France's economy has reached record new lows. France's penchant for protesting also seems to be dwindling, despite the widespread economic hardship. Rami Mazoheri reports from Paris.
For the first time since the presidential vote, France's unions marched nationwide, as the nation's public services will likely be under major attack for the next 5 years. Polls show President Emmanuel Macron will likely have almost as strong a grip over parliament as in his first term.
Unions repeatedly warned that the coronavirus was being instrumentalized to accelerate the long-standing neoliberal goal of defunding public services. Now they face a re-elected Macron who could be more powerful and confrontational than ever.
Macron's policies have meant the ending of so many social services and not replacing public servants who retire. This means those still working are doing double the amount of work as before, and that has led to burnout, illness, and even suicide attempts. If Macron would come talk to us, he would see that we are not being treated fairly, but I doubt he will.
New data shows the French economy has stagnated to the brink of a recession. Inflation in the Eurozone just hit its highest annual level since the currency began in 1999. That combination spells stagflation, something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy, and it comes after a decade of austerity measures which were allegedly supposed to strengthen the Eurozone.
The inflation index point has not been changed in a decade for civil servants, so our salaries have been constantly falling, and this was before this year's record increase in inflation. On top of this, they are asking us to work longer for the same pay, so our hourly wage is being reduced and we have less time away from work to be with our family and friends.
Despite the new lows in economic data, unions were not able to draw as many to march as in years past. Since the coronavirus restrictions began to be lifted last fall, many have noted that French protests are occurring less often and are smaller in size. It could be that, after a decade of mostly failed labor efforts, workers simply can't afford to miss work anymore. Or many have given up trying to influence Brussels or the French government. Or many French could be too scared to protest given what happened to the Yellow Vests. Rami Mazaheri, Paris.
The Partygate scandal continues to haunt the British Prime Minister as more members of his Conservative Party call on him to quit. A total of 27 MPs are now saying Boris Johnson should go, a week after a long-awaited report into lockdown rule-breaking parties at the Prime Minister's residence. Saipur Reza reports from London.
The British Parliament is in recess, but the letters are coming in. Only a week after a damning report by Sue Gray into Downing Street parties and Chancellor Rishi Sunak's £15 billion to help with the soaring cost of living.
The high command of the Conservative Party are in Operation Distraction now, with handouts, with talk about the Ukraine war, and many other things too. But the party is currently in Operation Frustration. They elected Boris Johnson to be a great asset when it came to winning votes. At the moment, he's losing them votes.
So far this week, three more letters of no confidence, including one from former Attorney General Jeremy Wright, who said that with regret he concluded that for the good of this and future governments, the Prime Minister should step down. 37 MPs have now publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. Out of those, two don't think he should go yet, eight are on the fence, and 27 want him to go now.
For a vote of no confidence to take place, 54 Conservative MPs will have to request it. But it's impossible to know exactly how many of them have already handed in their letters of no confidence because it's all done in secret. And some MPs are saying they're going to wait until after the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, celebrated this week, before they decide if Boris Johnson has to resign.
There isn't a clear successor to him that might bring them electoral advantage. And while they talk about the Jubilee, let's wait after that, they've mentioned the same thing about the Sue Gray report, about the police inquiry. In reality, they're waiting to see if this finally dies down or if this is a chronic condition, like malaria rather than COVID, that never goes away. And if it doesn't go away for Boris, then Boris is going to have to go away from the Conservatives.
There is also a question mark over what went down during COVID lockdowns in the Prime Minister's private apartment at the time. Allegations of another gathering on the day of Boris Johnson's birthday. But all eyes will be on the outcome of the upcoming by-elections beyond London, following the resignations of two disgraced Conservative MPs. Wakefield MP Imran Ahmed Khan, found guilty of sexually assaulting a teenage boy in 2008, and Tiverton and Honiton MP Neil Parish for watching pornography in Parliament. If the Tories lose, a ballot on Johnson's leadership is almost certain. Saeed Porizep, London.
That's your world news for now. Stay with us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Shirin Abu Aqila's death demonstrates the disregard the Zionist regime has for Palestinian lives, how it whitewashes its responsibility for Palestinian deaths, and how its powerful allies shield it from accountability. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Will ICC help Israeli regime get away with Shirin Abu Aqila's murder? Here's more on the story. If the Zionist regime thought that the international heat over the apparent targeted killing of iconic Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aqila would blow over in a couple of weeks, it was very wrong. One can understand, however, why the fake regime of Israel would make such a calculation. It has gotten away with intentionally killing Palestinian journalists, paramedics, and persons with disabilities, with little consequence other than demands for accountability from human rights investigators that have gone ignored by Israel's international accomplices. It has repeatedly attacked Palestinians inside Gaza, where there is no safety from the Zionist regime's bombs in the territory, under economic blockade and comprehensive closure since 2007. All this is on top of the Zionist regime's blatantly illegal settlement enterprise in the West Bank and Golan Heights, and its brutal pacification of any and all forms of resistance against it. On top of that is the Zionist regime's frequent lethal violations of Lebanese and Syrian sovereignty, as well as its international assassinations and global export of weapons and repression technologies. Abu Aghal worked for Al Jazeera, funded by Qatar, and held U.S. citizenship, making her murder an international issue that won't be quickly swept under the rug. Indeed, her shocking death is proving a turning point in multiple ways. She exposed the Zionist regime's lies even after her death, and, in the words of Muhammad al-Kurd, she liberated Al-Quds, however briefly, as the Palestinian people united in outrage and poured into the streets to pay their respects, a mass gathering not seen in years as the Zionist regime violently represses Palestinian public life in the city. And Abu Aghle may yet expose the complicity of the U.S. regime in shoring up the Israeli regime impunity, even as Biden administration officials, some of whom knew her personally, claim to seek accountability for her killing. The Palestinian Authority announced the results of its investigation into Abu Aghle's death recently, saying that the Zionist regime forces deliberately shot and killed her while she was fleeing their fire. The PA's investigation was based on interviews with witnesses, an inspection of the scene, and a forensic medical report, Akram al-Khatib, the PA Attorney General, told the media. The investigation determined that Abu Aghle was hit by a high-velocity armor-piercing 5.56mm bullet fired from a Roger Mini 14 semi-automatic rifle, a U.S.-manufactured weapon. The reporter was wearing a helmet and protective vest marked as press when she was shot in the back of the head. The Zionist regime's military has stonewalled its investigation into Abu Aghle's death by claiming that it needs the bullet that killed her for ballistics testing and blaming the PA for refusing to hand it over. The Zionist regime has, however, failed to disclose the GPS coordinates of all its troops who were present in Jenin refugee camp when Abu Aghle was killed, nor has it published in full the footage from the troops' body cameras that were apparently in operation at the time of her death. An Israeli regime military spokesperson has declined to say when it would release the additional footage from the morning of Abu Aghle's death or describe what it shows, the AP news agency reported recently. AP's reconstruction of events published this week suggests that the Zionist regime fire killed the journalist. Witnesses interviewed by the news agency insisted there were no militants in the area between the reporters and the army, contradicting the Zionist regime's claim that there was an exchange of fire at the time. Benny Gantz, the Zionist regime's war minister, rejected the Palestinian Authority's findings, stating that any claim that the Israeli military intentionally targets journalists or those uninvolved in terror is a crude and blatant lie. Aviv Kochavi, the Zionist regime's military chief, repeated similar claims, saying that no IDF soldier deliberately fired at a journalist. We investigated this. That is the conclusion, and there is no other. Kochavi emphatically did not deny that an Israeli soldier killed her, but he implied that Abu Aghle's death was an operational error in a combat zone, even though there was no exchange of fire between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian fighters at the time, as witnesses and survivors have testified and is shown in video footage of the journalist's final moments. The Zionist regime's president Isaac Herzog dismissed another investigation by CNN as fake facts, while the Zionist regime's military stated that the claim that the shooting was deliberate lacks any foundation. The conclusion of CNN's forensic investigation was more forceful than that of AP, suggesting that the reporter was deliberately targeted. Thank you. despite the claims by the Zionist regime's top military and political figures that its army doesn't target journalists, an independent UN Commission of Inquiry found that troops did just that during Gaza's Great March of Return protest. Israeli forces have intentionally shot children. They have intentionally shot people with disabilities. They have intentionally shot journalists, knowing them to be children, people with disabilities and journalists. Sarah Hussein, one of the three investigators appointed by the UN Human Rights Council, said in 2019. More than 215 Palestinians were killed during those protests, which began in late March 2018 and were suspended in December 2019. Only one Israeli regime troop had been indicted over the use of live fire against unarmed protesters during the Great March of Return as of late 2020. The Zionist regime's killing and maiming of Gaza protesters is a main focus of the International Criminal Court's investigation in Palestine that was launched in March last year. The Palestinian Authority has requested that the tribunal in The Hague also investigate Shirin Abu Aghla's killing. Recently, a coalition of 34 press freedom and human rights groups called for an immediate and independent investigation into Abu Aghla's killing. Failing an independent and impartial investigation by Israel, the groups call on the ICC to determine if this incident amounts to a war crime. Shortly before Abu Aghla's killing, the International Criminal Court received a separate complaint alleging war crimes against journalists by Israeli regime occupation forces. The complaint concerns the systematic targeting of four Palestinian media workers who were killed or maimed by Zionist snipers while covering demonstrations in Gaza, according to International Federation of Journalists. The killing of Abu Aghla was added to that complaint. It was announced recently. The Biden administration says that it does not support an ICC investigation into the killing of Abu Aghla, while insisting that it expects full accountability for those responsible for her killing. Washington has deferred to the Zionist regime's military self-investigation protocol. The U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price has pointed to Israel's investigation into a street execution of Iyad Halak, a Palestinian with disabilities and autistic traits, as an example of the Zionist regime's ability to investigate itself. Halak's family, however, characterizes the Israeli regime probe as a cover-up. The young man would record his walk to and from his school for adults with disabilities every day, but his phone was returned to them with its contents deleted. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime claims that all 10 cameras in the area were somehow not working at the time that Halak was shot dead by police as his teacher pleaded for them to stop. The Zionist regime is quick to release footage showing its forces executing Palestinians when it thinks it supports its narrative of events, as it did immediately after Abu Aghla's killing. A video montage published by the fake regime of Israel shortly after Abu Aghla's death suggested that she was killed by a bullet fired by resistance forces. The Zionist regime's made video was swiftly debunked by Israeli human rights group B'Tselem. A field investigation by that group found that it would have been physically impossible for any bullet fired by forces in video distributed by the Zionist regime to have hit Abu Aghla. The Zionist regime also released heavily edited clips of footage from troops' body cameras that morning. If the Zionist regime sits on the fall on edited body camera footage, it is all but certain, because it would prove the guilt of its troops. The Zionist regime has never released the footage of the 2016 shooting death of 16-year-old Mahmoud Shalon, a U.S. citizen, at a West Bank checkpoint where presumably numerous video cameras would be present.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends. And here is a short and sweet saying from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. Peace be upon him. Say good wording, and it will be your distinctive feature. Do good deeds, and you will be reckoned with its people.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Purposeful Friendship. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of being purposeful in selecting a friendship. And when we talk about the friendship, obviously we need to show a kind of behavior in the Islamic lifestyle. But the first thing in the behavior in relation to the friendship, which Islam emphasizes on, is that the friendship must be purposeful. And that purpose is to reach to the perfection, because when we look at the statements in the Islamic teachings, when we look at the Quran, we see that in the Quran, even some people they say that, oh, why we did not choose such a person as a friend, or why we did choose the wrong person as a friend. Where the statement is, Ya waylati laytani lam attakhiz fulanan khalila, that I wished that I never have chosen such a person as a friend. Why? Because it is without a purpose, without having in mind that this friendship can lead me towards the right path, or maybe it can lead me towards the wrong path. And since we never think about friendship like this, we never set a goal for the friendship. We never set a goal to choose a friend and on which basis we should choose. That's why there are some people who will have this wish on the day of judgment. Therefore, we will talk about the purposeful friendship and what does it mean, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of purposeful friendship in the Islamic lifestyle, and we said that the friendship should be purposeful. Why? Because when we look at the our social life and we look at our goals that we need to achieve, and when we look at the issues that are in the state of materialism or the spirituality, therefore, when we need to choose a friend, it should be in line with the goal and the purpose that we have. It should be purposeful. It should be in line with the goal that I have selected for my life. For example, if I want to be the best person in the society, if I want to reach to the perfection, therefore, I need to choose a friend who can help me in order to reach to this perfection, in order to be the best person in the society. I need a friend who can tell me about my faults, who really will take a pain for me and who will really help me out in order to be the best person. If I am studying, I need to have a friend who helped me in the studies. I need a friend who takes care of me and he knows about me and he really wants me to reach to my goal. And this should be seen when we choose a friend, which generally we do not do. Generally, we choose friend because of our senses, because I feel good with such a person. That's why I'm choosing that person as a friend. And this should not be the case when we look in the Islamic studies. Islam says that you need to intellectually choose your friend and not with the senses or with the feelings that you have. Generally, we choose a friend because we feel good about them. And this is not the criteria in the Islamic lifestyle. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
The contemporary ceramics exhibition kicks off at the Villa d'Atres Art Foundation near the French city of Avignon. The exhibit showcases nearly 130 artworks of all sizes. Some are so big they are put on display outdoors. The foundation has created these modern forms from roughly 100 artists from all over the world. The exhibit displays an exceptional diversity of eclectic works presenting sophisticated skills and artistry. Participating artists say working with clay and playing with glazes always produces a unique item that often generates a profoundly universal reaction. The goal of the event is to show how ceramic art has returned to the forefront of the contemporary art scene. The annual Vivid Life Festival has returned to Sydney after being cancelled 2 years in a row due to the coronavirus pandemic. The event kicked off with fireworks and lighting the sails of the Sydney Opera House. Iconic structures like the Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia are part of a series of new canvases this time around. As an added treat, the 2022 festival also has the longest continuous light walk in the history of the event. Plus, this year's highlights include a choreographed light show by 600 drones. Both residents and tourists have been anticipating the return of the show.
I saw it about 8 years ago, I think, and it's just got better and better, as far as I can tell. I mean, the Opera House is the most amazing canvas possible to project, this just amazing digital artwork. The vibrancy of it, the colour of it, the animation of it, the explosiveness of it, the colour just bursts out in just amazing ways. That the snakes, the chameleons, the lizards crawling across it.
The Harbour City will glow with 50 light installations, the projection artworks, as well as over 100 musical events. Vivid Sydney is an annual festival that lasts for 23 nights, infusing art, innovation and technology while collaborating with boundary-pushing artists. In 2019, the festival attracted millions of attendees. The event is owned and managed by the Tourism and Major Events Agency of the Government of New South Wales. Chilean scientists believe they have found the world's oldest living tree in a lush green forest in the south of the country. The scientists say their study shows an ancient cypress known as the Great Grandfather might have been beaten the record for the world's oldest tree by six centuries. The bristlescone pine tree in eastern California is the current record holder with over 4,800 years of age. The scientist who led the study says the sample they extracted and other dating methods suggest that the Chilean cypress with a 4 meter thick trunk is over 5,000 years old.
We could count all the rings, but we know it's not the tree's age. It's an estimation of what we call a minimum age. So for this kind of tree, the scientific challenge is to estimate with science the part that we do not see and that is missing. And that is what we did with the millennial alerce. This method tells us that 80% of all possible growth trajectories give us an age of this living tree greater than 5,000 years. There's only a 20% chance that the tree is younger.
Borichevich is, however, concerned about visitors harming the tree, which is located in the Costero National Park. He says visitors are still able to circle the tree's base, step on its roots, and even take pieces of its bark. The tree is a conifer native to Chile and Argentina and can grow to heights of up to 45 meters.
The world's oldest living man has just turned 113 years and says he's going to be around at least 10 more years. Good for him. Born on May the 27th, 1909 in Venezuela, Juan Vicente Perez Mora is still in pink of his health and memory and does not take medication. He has no trouble recalling his childhood marriage and the names of his siblings, children, and grandchildren. He has 41 grandchildren, by the way. So what is the secret behind a long life? Work hard, rest on holidays, go to bed early, love for God, and always carry him in your heart. The Guinness World Records declared Perez Mora the oldest living person last week. The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Humans have disrupted the turtle survival for years due to their greed for meat, eggs, skin, and shells. But the decreasing population of the species is creating conscience of conservation. Cambodians have released hundreds of turtles of an endangered variety into the wild on World Turtle Day. About 600 Cantor's giant soft-shell turtles were let into a river in northeastern Cambodia. After people collected the species from a holding pool, Cambodian monks blessed the tiny creatures, then set them free. The Wildlife Conservation Society was the organizer of this event. It said that only a few records of Cantor turtles have remained in Laos, while they have mostly been wiped out in Vietnam and Thailand. The body has so far released over 1,500 hatchlings into the wild in 2022. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a wildflower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate. A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge is 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtanaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Youssef Jalali from Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, a 52-page analysis by an unnamed historian concludes the origins of the deep-rooted racism of the Windrush scandal lie in the fact that during the period 1950 to 1981, every single piece of immigration or citizenship legislation was designed at least in part to reduce the number of people with black or brown skin who were permitted to live and work in the United Kingdom. We now present you an article written by Amelia Gentleman. The piece is titled, Report Says Windrush Scandal Caused by 30 Years of Racist Immigration Laws.
Mm-hmm.
According to a leaked government report, the origins of the Windrush scandal lay in 30 years of racist immigration legislation designed to reduce the UK's non-white population. The stark conclusion was set out in a Home Office Commission paper that officials have repeatedly tried to suppress over the past year. The 52-page analysis by an unnamed historian, which has been seen by The Guardian, describes how the British Empire depended on racist ideology in order to function, and sets out how this affected the laws passed in the post-war period. It concludes that the origins of the deep-rooted racism of the Windrush scandal lie in the fact that during the period 1950 to 1981, every single piece of immigration or citizenship legislation was designed, at least in part, to reduce the number of people with black or brown skin who were permitted to live and work in the United Kingdom. It finds that the scandal was caused by a failure to recognise that changes to British immigration law over the past 70 years had a more negative impact on black people than on other racial and ethnic groups. The report states, as a result, the experiences of Britain's black communities, of the Home Office, of the law, and of life in the United Kingdom have been fundamentally different from those of white communities. The report adds, major immigration legislation in 1962, 1968, and 1971 was designed to reduce the proportion of people living in the United Kingdom who did not have white skin. It was not clear why UK officials were reluctant to release the document. Diane Abbott MP, who attempted without success to have the paper released through the Home Affairs Select Committee, said the Home Office appeared to be unwilling to acknowledge the racism that has disfigured British immigration policy for decades. The report was commissioned by the Home Office as part of a commitment to educating civil servants about the causes of the Windrush scandal, which saw thousands of people wrongly classified as illegal immigrants by the department. After the scandal, ministers agreed to teach all 35,000 Home Office employees about Britain's colonial history and the history of black Britons. The report, named The Historical Roots of the Windrush Scandal, focuses on the immigration legislation of the 20th century rather than on more recent events, such as the effects of the hostile environment policies introduced by Theresa May when she was Home Secretary. The unnamed Home Office historian writes, "The British Empire depended on racist ideology in order to function, which in turn produced legislation aimed at keeping racial and ethnic groups apart. From the beginning, concern about Commonwealth immigration was about skin colour." The report states, in the 1950s, British officials shared a basic assumption that coloured immigrants, as they were referred to, were not good for British society. The document summarises decades of dysfunctional relationships between Britain's institutions and black and minority ethnic groups, and concludes, "The politics of Britain's borders, which have been administered for more than a century by the Home Office, are now inextricably connected with race and with Britain's colonial history." Wendy Williams, the independent inspector advising the Home Office on what changes to make after the Windrush scandal, said in March that she was disappointed the report had not been published a year after officials had signed off on it. It has been made available to staff internally, but requests for it to be made public have been repeatedly rejected. A Freedom of Information request about the document was refused. Acknowledging that the subject was a matter of legitimate public interest and that openness and transparency were important, the request was nevertheless rejected on the grounds that the Home Office's response to the Windrush scandal included sensitive issues involving the development of policies. Publication of the document could inhibit discussions and the ability of ministers to take free and frank advice. Immigration historians said it was peculiar to suppress a work of history that was funded by the taxpayer. There was speculation over whether the report was withheld internally for a year because its conclusions were at odds with the British government's narrative on race. Last year, Tony Sewell's Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities